I want to talk about where we're finding endocrine disrupting chemicals and how we might be exposed to them. So the previous talks focused on exposure and being able to measure it in the population, but you know, I think the question comes back to where are we being exposed to these things? How are they getting into our bodies? And there's a lot of data to suggest that it's actually in our food. And so I wanted to talk a little bit more about what we know about that. So most of you know that our bodies produce hormones. There's many different endocrine organs that make and secrete different hormones into our blood, but we also carry in our bodies many different hormonally active chemicals, which are legally approved and used in food packaging. And that includes microwavable containers, plastic tubing from processing, canned food. There's probably many more that we could come up with. The FDA regulates the use of food additives. We know that there are over 3,000 chemicals that have been approved as indirect food additives. That means they're not actually intentionally added to the food. They're not like food dyes or colors, but they're things that come into contact with the food, either in packaging or in processing. So if you think about like a big vat of milk that comes from the dairy and then is put into the truck, and then the truck is transported somewhere and to the dairy processing plant, all the tubing and all the materials that come into contact with that milk during that transit time, when it actually shows up in a jar or a jug on your kitchen table, all of those materials have been approved as food additives. It also includes all the inks, adhesives, and other materials that you might find on a label that you don't actually think of as being in contact with the food, as well as anyone who might handle food, including the use of PVC gloves. So I think all of you know the story about BPA, and we know that food is a major source of BPA exposure in the human population. It's coming primarily from canned foods, canned beverages, and it's been taken out of infant formula and some other food contact surface substances like baby bottles and sippy cups, which is great, but there's still something that's in the can lining. And what is that replacement chemical? For the most part, we don't know. We do know that all of these chemicals I have listed in the left-hand column here, which many of which have already been mentioned today, are approved as food additives. That includes phthalates, the perfluorinated chemicals, benzophenones, which have come up as sunscreen ingredients earlier, but the same reason that they're in sunscreen as UV stabilizers is the same reason that they're used in food contact substances. Parabens are also approved as food additives, as well as organotins. And we also know that 9 out of 10 of us or more in this room carry levels of all of these chemicals in our body, and many of them have already been mentioned, the phthalates, the perfluorinated chemicals, the parabens. All of them in the CDC and Haynes biomonitoring study have been measured in the human population. So the question is whether or not food is a major source of exposure to these chemicals. And in the case of phthalates, I think when we think about where we might be exposed to them, we tend to think about its use as a plasticizer in PVC. So it used to be in kids' toys. We know that it's in fragrances, air fresheners, colognes, and other types of personal care products. It's in medical devices. It's in cosmetics. But it's also actually used quite a bit in food packaging and food processing equipment. Phthalates are approved. There are at least two dozen different phthalates that have been approved for dozens of different applications since the 1950s and 60s by the FDA. There was a review article published a couple of years ago that looked at where these phthalates are approved and where they're used. They're found in a lot of the milk processing equipment, including in the PVC tubing, which is very similar to what we see in hospitals, where it can be 40% by weight DEHP. Other phthalates like DINP, DIDP, DBP, these are all the phthalates that have been banned from kids' toys, but they're still legally used as food additives. It's also used in paperboard and packaging. So the middle picture that I have here is a bakery box. You know, you might get a box of donuts or a cake or maybe something a little healthier, I'm not sure, a fruit tart. Bananas? A box of bananas? That seems a little bit of an overkill. But there are a number of different phthalates that have been measured in this packaging, in part because sometimes it's made of recycled content, so the phthalates end up and the recycled content, but they're also used in the adhesives and the glues and the inks that are printed on this board. And then interestingly, the cellulosic cover, like the cellophane cover, can contain actually pretty high levels of DEP, which have been found to migrate into the food. And they don't even come into contact. It's just that because they're volatilizing, they seem to be taken up by the food items. Phthalates are hydrophobic fat-loving chemicals, so they will attach to fatty foods like milk or other oily-based foods. And finally, phthalates can be found in PVC gloves. So there have been other studies of food contamination pre and post handling with people who were wearing PVC gloves, where they found that the food actually took up the phthalates that were in the gloves. In all of these cases, it's because the phthalates aren't tightly bound to the plastic, but they come off with use, they volatilize, and they can migrate into oily substances. The concern about phthalates, I think we've heard a little bit about already, is that they are hormone-disrupting chemicals. They're anti-androgenic. They interfere with the male sex hormone testosterone. In animal studies, they've been linked to a whole host of effects that's been coined the term phthalate syndrome, which is small or abnormal reproductive organs in male animals, undescended testicles or cryptorchidism, hypospadias, which is a birth defect of the way that the penis forms, and later in life, decreased sperm counts and infertility. In human studies, similar changes have been found with exposure early in life to phthalates, altered development of the male genitals, altered levels of testosterone in baby boys, and then some non-reproductive effects, which are curious and interesting, changes in play behavior, increase in allergies and asthma symptoms, and increased waist circumference, which is associated with some of the metabolic changes that we've seen in the human population associated with diabetes. We do know, and a lot of the federal agencies have already said this for many years, that the major source of exposure for most of us to phthalates is in our food. And the FDA has said that, the EPA, the National Toxicology Program. But prior to a couple of years ago, we didn't really have a lot of data to support that in the U.S. The Breast Cancer Fund and Silent Spring Institute did a study a couple of years ago with some Bay Area families where they gave them a diet for a couple of days that was free of processed food, microwave food, canned food, and they measured their exposure to BPA and phthalates before and after the intervention with the diet and found a dramatic and significant reduction in both BPA and DEHP, which is a form of phthalate exposure. There was a similar study of a population of individuals who went to a meditation retreat in Korea who were on a strict vegetarian diet for 5 days. They again measured levels of phthalate and other chemical exposures pre and post diet. And in this study, they found a significant reduction in some of the phthalates, but not in DEHP. But in the U.S., we don't really know which foods contain phthalates. There's been no testing of U.S. food supply that I've been able to see of which foods are most contaminated. There are studies of European and Japanese foods where milk, cheese, and other oily-based foods tend to be the ones that are most contaminated with phthalates. There was a cross-sectional survey done by Dr. Schechter's group of the NHANES population, which found that in the dietary survey in the NHANES survey, people who noted that they ate more poultry tended to have higher levels of DEHP. People who ate more vegetables had higher levels of DEP. But again, we don't know exactly which foods in the U.S. are being are contaminated. So this data was actually presented last year by Kat Navarro, who's sitting in the back of the room. We did a pilot study of foods purchased here in California. We looked for 17 different phthalates and kind of a wide range of oily, fatty type of foods. And we found DEHP in all of them. We found DBP in a couple of them and DEP in only one. But interestingly, we didn't find any of the other phthalates in these products. And when you look at, you know, which ones tended to be the most, had the highest levels, it was actually milk and butter and oils, which tended to have the highest levels of DEHP in the food. So, it's really hard, actually, to do phthalate food testing. And we have met a number of challenges in this project, including when I've tried to talk to some food chemists about it, they've equated measuring phthalates in food to measuring the weight of a captain of a boat by taking the whole weight of him and his boat together and then having him get off and reweighing the boat. We're trying to measure very low levels of a chemical in an environment where they are everywhere. They're in the lab environment. There's very high levels of background. And then the analysis itself is very challenging because unlike a biological fluid like blood or urine, which tends to be watery, foods can be very oily. They gum up the machines, and it's very hard to get an extract of the food that you can actually reliably measure phthalate levels in. So it's actually not that surprising that there hasn't been a lot of testing done of phthalates in food in the food supplies because the methods are very, very challenging. The pilot testing that we just did was using gas chromatography mass spec with a selective ion mode scan. It turns out that the limit of detection in that test is around the low part per million level, which is probably a little bit too high to be able to reliably detect it. So our next steps in this project, I'm hoping, will be that we can work with this laboratory, which is based in Petaluma and does a lot of environmental sampling of phthalates, to perfect our food extract sampling, and then work with Dr. Girona here, who has a much more sensitive phthalate measure method to measure the levels of phthalates in the food extracts that that we've created. Before we end and have a discussion, I just wanted to bring up one other issue of contaminants, endocrine-disrupting chemicals that are contaminants in the food supply. And triclosan is something that we just talked about. Its chemical cousin is triclocarban. They're both used in personal care products as antibacterial chemicals. Triclosan, as you heard, is used in hand soaps and a number of other consumer products. Triclocarban is used primarily in deodorant bar soaps, so like Safeguard and Dial deodorant soaps. And both of these chemicals are common environmental contaminants, and this is how it happens. You wash your hands, the water and the soap go down the drain, they go to that sewage treatment plant. The water is treated and discharged into wherever it's sent. And that water is actually has relatively low levels of triclosan and triclocarban. But the sludge that comes out at the bottom, the sewage sludge, has actually really high levels of triclosan and triclocarban. Some estimates are 2/3 of the mass of all the contaminants in that sludge are triclosan and triclocarban together. And that sludge, as you probably know, it undergoes some magical treatment that transforms it into biosolids, which doesn't actually remove the chemicals. And then those solids are applied to our agricultural fields as fertilizer. So the concern, of course, is that all the contaminants that are in this biosolid might be ending up in our food supply. And there was a study done, published 2 years ago in Environmental Science and Technology, where they grew soybeans in a greenhouse under conditions that would mimic what you would see in a farm field. They treated the soil with the same levels of triclosan and triclocarban that you might see in biosolids. They watered them with water that had about the same levels of contaminant, and they looked to see, did the plant bring up the contaminants? And they found a lot in the root, a little bit in the stem and leaves, and they also found it in the soybeans. This particular study was done in soybeans. And other researchers have followed up that study looking at other plants. So this is zucchini and pumpkins, and carrots was the latest one that was published. All of them take up triclosan and triclocarban when grown under conditions similar to what you would see in the environment. So the problem is that, you know, the widespread use of this really unproven chemical for its efficacy and questionable safety is now ending up in our food supply. But really, it's the academics who have unveiled this that's happening, not because the Food and Drug Administration is monitoring our food supply. In the study with the pumpkins and zucchini, they tried to estimate, like, okay, so we found it in the plants. If somebody was eating a lot of this, how much would they actually be exposed to compared to, say, if they were using a deodorant soap product? And the soap products still trump in terms of exposure how much triclosan you would be exposed to. But it's actually within the, you know, a magnitude of order or so. And if you were, they estimated that if you were a vegetarian who ate a diet high in vegetarian food, and didn't use deodorant soaps, you would probably get most of your exposure from your vegetables. So, what does this all mean? I think, as I mentioned in the beginning, there are over 50 different endocrine disrupting chemicals that have been approved as food additives. We know a lot about BPA in the food supply, but those other 49, we know essentially nothing. We don't know which foods are most contaminated how that contamination is occurring. The FDA has said that food is a major source of exposure to phthalates, but in the intervention studies that have been done and the pilot testing that has been done do suggest that, but there actually is no comprehensive testing that's been done by any federal agency to show us which types of foods are most contaminated. We're hopeful that some of these new methods with much lower limits of detection will be able to overcome some of the methodological challenges, which I mentioned. And I'm also hopeful that, well, what we're calling for actually is that these dozens of endocrine disrupting chemicals that have been approved as food additives have really not undergone any reevaluation of their safety since they were first approved in the 1950s and 60s. When endocrine disruption was not on the radar screen of anyone, it wasn't a concept that was understood. And so we really do need to have the FDA update their safety evaluations, taking into account the new science, as well as doing a better job of surveying the food supply for contamination by these chemicals that are approved as indirect food additives. And these are some references. This presentation, of course, will be available later. And I didn't get a chance to tell you all about NRDC, but if you don't know who we are, I encourage you to go to our website. I also failed to acknowledge the support of the Passport Science Innovation Fund for the triclosan project, which was described earlier. So thank you for your attention, and I think we'll just maybe open up the floor to questions for all of the projects.